This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good morning, I'm Sharad Kutin with me, Tan Chung Han, and the morning run begins. It's steep ascent, you know, from 10, from now, 6 o'clock, all the way up to 10 o'clock in the morning.
Usually you say it as a stratosphere, but I guess 10 a.m. equals the stratosphere. Sure enough, good morning, folks. Tan Chung Han here. And it's going to be quite the morning here, I think.
Just a quick roundup on, on the news that came out as we slept. Let's start with a very interesting note from the Japanese astronaut who said that he had grown some 3.5 inches since arriving on the International Space Station over 3 weeks ago. That caught everybody beside, you know, they were beside themselves. Think that just after 3 weeks, he should grow so much in space. The idea is, was there something special in the air, or at least the atmosphere, or the lack of atmospheric pressure?
Yeah, 3.5 inches, that translates to 9 cm. Now, the reason that is astonishing, because on average, astronauts only grow 2 to 5 cm in space.
You know, do they shrink back when they reach planet Earth?
I have no idea. I've never been to space, you know, but still, if there's a prospect of me, or is a chance of me growing 2 to 5 cm, if I go to space, you know, I might just sign up for that. But I think what's troubling here is that you've got an astronaut who made what he calls a measurement mistake. Once again, an astronaut making a measurement mistake doesn't really instill confidence in the space program there. I mean, you would think these guys are experts when it comes to numbers, at least.
Yeah, blaming your tools, I think it's called. Okay, also in the news, armed robbers have seized millions of euros worth of merchandise from a jewelry shop at the famous Ritz Hotel in Paris. Mm. Now, isn't the Ritz Hotel also the scene of several other robberies of note in the recent past?
Oh, was it?
Yeah.
Oh,
wow. But I'm now blanking out. I think there was a well-known American singer or actress who was robbed at the Ritz. But okay, but still, the Ritz, big name and big numbers there when it comes to the robbery.
Yeah, well, I don't frequent such places there. It's kind of beyond my socioeconomic status there. But sure, I'll take your word for it, Sharad.
Okay. journalists are under threat around the world. You remember that Myanmar story of the two Reuters journalists? They've been charged with Official Secret Act, under the Official Secrets Act. Apparently, the state believes that they were trying to uncover and then publish information that proved positively that the Myanmar military was in fact engaging in ethnic cleansing and seeking to target Rohingya communities and murder them. Also, in the news, a prominent Pakistani journalist escaped an attempt to abduct him from the capital, Islamabad. This is actually after a series of abductions of both intellectuals and journalists in that country. Quite a scary state of affairs there.
Yeah, and so the name of this journalist is Taha As-Siddiqui, who claims that 10 to 12 unidentified men actually beat him and threatened to kill him as he took a cab to the airport.
Okay, we'll be back with a discussion about happiness. Stay tuned, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, I'm Sharad Kutin with me, Tan Chung Han. The morning run continues. It's just past 8 minutes after 6 on the 11th of January 2018. The question is, Han, for you, are you happy?
Well, I guess you are talking about this survey by jobstreet.com.
Where no, I'm actually talking about
me.
You. Okay. Are you happy this morning?
So in short, yes, I am happy at, very much happy at BFM 89.9. And apparently I'm not alone because plenty of Malaysians apparently are quite happy with their jobs, at least when it comes to JobStreet's Job Happiness Index.
Yeah, country manager for JobStreet, Chuk Yung Ning, says Malaysia scored 4.65 on a 10-point scale out of 10,000 employees surveyed. 58% said they are happy with their jobs. Now, the question is whether this even strikes you as intuitive, right, or counterintuitive. The countries that we were compared to, Han, were Indonesia, Vietnam, the Philippines, Thailand, and Singapore, all in the region, and then one other country, Hong Kong.
Mm. Yeah, and I think this is interesting because given all the rumblings that we hear out there, you know, very often when colleagues get together, it's a lot of gossip and, you know, it's a lot of negative tones. And on one hand, it's cathartic, right? So that's great in that sense. But to then see these results, yeah, it kind of makes you scratch your head a little bit.
Okay. Right? So what is it that's going into this mix, and who did they speak to exactly? Apparently, they spoke to people in sales, engineering, and healthcare. In sales, they spoke to people in telemarketing. Yeah. Now, that's a job that does not strike me as one that produces great happiness generally.
Yeah. First-hand experience, I had a pseudo-telemarketing job. I worked in a call center fielding calls from prospective students at my university who would ask questions about the university and get them enrolled and applications and whatnot, right? It was terrible. It just drained the life out of me. So to see these results that the happiest employees were those in sales, specifically telesales and telemarketing, that is very, very odd, to say the least. Again, given my personal experience.
Okay, so I've never been in telemarketing, but I can just imagine
you.
Because I'm often the other person at the other end of the line, being unhelpful, being uncooperative, telling them to call back in an hour, and actually just knowing that this is not a genuine call. It's not something to say, sorry, are you busy? Because I got something really important to say to you. And I'm saying to myself, Sharad, this is not an important call. This is from some telemarketer.
But at the same, look, they're just there trying to earn a living, trying to get a paycheck. I don't think anyone really wakes up one day and says, hey, I want to be a telemarketer.
Okay. Well, maybe we shouldn't dump so much on telemarketers. But the survey cited three top factors that affect job happiness: convenient work location, good relationship with colleagues, and company reputation.
Right.
Do you think your company's reputation has an impact on how you feel about yourself?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, definitely. Because if, let's say, God forbid, you work for a company that's tainted with some kind of scandal, you're not necessarily, going out there and just, waving your resume into people's faces. Or you might be a bit apprehensive when associating yourself with that company. So I think it plays a big part. But of those three factors that you mentioned there, I think chief of them all would be the good relationship with colleagues, because you might find yourself in a less than ideal workplace, but if you're surrounded with enough support, you have that network, and there's enough camaraderie, I think that goes a long ways. I mean, whether or not it's actually beneficial for you and your personal well-being, that's a different discussion.
Yeah, I agree with you there. A good working environment, a place you want to wake up in the morning for, is so important. Mm-hmm. Now, the top three factors causing unhappiness are poor leadership, a lack of career development, and a lack of training opportunities. And I think the last two really kind of suggest, jobs where that feel like dead ends, like this is not going to take you any further. It puts a full stop, as it were, to your career development.
Yeah, no, certainly. But also, I think poor leadership, right? How often have we heard this phrase whereby people quit jobs, or rather people quit managers, not companies? And very often your superior, your immediate superior, has a huge impact on your current state of happiness and well-being, and also your career prospects, obviously.
Right. I mean, the consequence of feeling that you're in a dead-end job is to want to seek new jobs, because we're saying, well, okay, so maybe I could do this for a couple of years, but I'm going to have to move on. Mm. And in fact, that is the subject of our next discussion. And remember, you can be part of this conversation at any point in time. You can WhatsApp us at 018-789-8899, or you can tweet us at BFM Radio. Any quick thoughts, Han, on what you should not do when looking for your next job?
Well, how about we discuss it after this next song?
How about we don't discuss it with anybody in our current firm when we seek to move? Stay tuned. BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, that was it, the Electric Light Orchestra with All Over the World. I'm Shoy Kutin, and with me, Tan Chung Han. Do you know Xanadu, the movie, the musical, Han?
Nope.
Oh, well, that...
Enlighten me.
Olivia Newton-John was in it, okay. And I believe it was the Bee Gees and others. And the Electric Light Orchestra. This is a song from Xanadu, the musical.
Got it. I'll add it to my potential playlist.
Vintage movies that you have to watch. Okay. We were talking earlier about how happy Malaysians are in their jobs, especially people in telemarketing, of all things. But there they are. And if you are in telemarketing, remember, you can always join this conversation if you still want to pick up the phone at the end of the day. 018-789-8899, or you can tweet us at BFM. FM radio. But we also were talking about people who are unhappy because, you know, while the majority of people are happy, there's a minority that's unhappy and they might want to move along in their careers.
Yeah, so there's this article which lists things or the 7 worst mistakes you can make during a career change. Let's just dive right into them. Okay, so for example, and again, this is an article from Business Insider, I believe. So 1, don't make a rash decision. 2, don't choose a new career based on salary. 3, don't neglect doing job research in your next field. 4, don't quit without having another job lined up.
And that's a mistake I think a lot of people make.
Yeah, I've done that one before.
You've done it yourself?
Yeah, I'll tell you more about that later. So 5, don't neglect networking. 6, don't go back to school prematurely. And 7, don't fail to adjust your resume accordingly.
I like the penultimate one, the penultimate don't, which is don't go back to school prematurely. And because, you know, for some of us, there's this impulse when everything's going wrong and you feel like you're at a dead end. You think, wow, wouldn't it be nice to just go back to school and study and have that kind of, be immersed in something new, you know, and being in a kind of a, not in the hot seat, but, you know, really in a more passive position, you know, because you're learning things, right?
Right, and passive, and you have the whole structure, you have, you know, your next 2 years all lined up for you, all the classes you have to take.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, so you have to go through the rigors of life and having to make these life decisions, right?
Even at 52, Han, I still dream about going back to university.
So now, would that be premature then if you go back to school at 52? I wonder what constitutes premature, though, going back to school prematurely, because if you subscribe to this notion that, hey, you know, any kind of education or formal education and qualifications, it will add to your personal development, then will there ever be a bad time for it or premature time for it?
I don't know, really. That's a good one to ponder. But, okay, let's come back to the one that you said you, you know, encountered, which is to quit your job without having another one lined up. I've done it, too.
Okay, so should I go first or you go first? Okay,
You go first.
So
I like you so much.
All right. So this is at the height of the whole eat, pray, love thing. And you know, it's all about finding yourself and whatnot. So yeah, I ditched my job, you know, traveled around the world. Well, I made
more
stops in Europe, several places in Europe, you know, several places around here in ASEAN as well. And after, I don't know, like 2 months, I just got so sick and tired of it, though. I guess I'm someone who needs that structure and need that certainty, you know, that base, knowing that you had the steady income. And, you know, there's nothing that stops you from still finding yourself while still having a steady job.
Okay, so the point is you moved on because you had savings. So maybe savings was the buffer. So kind of emotionally or psychologically, you thought, well, I have enough money. I don't really need the next job. But there are a lot of people who don't have those savings. And yet, in a huff, because they're so angry and it often builds up over time, they quit. I've had friends in this situation, and, you know, I'm often telling them, just hold on, you know, grit your teeth and find that next job, because it's psychologically terrifying to be without a job and then scrambling around as your little savings shrink to nothing.
Right, and it very much depends on the job market's prospects and the economic conditions at that point in time as well, right? Because if you do this on a whim while, you know, people are just getting laid off left, right, and center, well, guess what? That period of joblessness could be extended for a lot longer than you planned for, right?
Yeah.
So which brings us to your story then, okay? How did you do it?
Well, I faxed my boss my resignation letter after 5 days at work. I was young and rash, and I did. And actually, those days, the economic situation wasn't grim. This was in the mid-90s, and Malaysia was booming. Mm. And people without much qualification or talent or personality could ask or command large salaries. I mean, that was just the nature of Kuala Lumpur in the mid-90s before we hit the Asian financial crisis, you know, inflated egos, inflated, you know, salaries and such. So I passed... feeding off that vibe, I thought I could find the next job quite easily. And I did, because I went into a job that was low paying but very fulfilling emotionally. So I decided, you know, I'd get into human rights work.
Well, hold on. So you revealed something quite telling there. So the whole inflated egos and expecting inflated salaries. See, that's not a millennial thing now, is it? It was evident there in the 90s even.
Absolutely. I mean, I think it's a function.
1 point for millennials there.
Yeah. I mean, I think millennials get knocked quite a bit for people of my generation. generation who often forget that that many of our attitudes are formed by the environment in which we are in, right? So if the economy is booming, I mean, we can knock millennials down because they're going to have a hard time because they're not earning enough to leave the family home and lead independent lives and, you know, and look like adults. So, you know, of course it's easy to dump on millennials.
But then, you know, being able to quit on the whim, I admit this, Sharad, at least I felt this way. You know, it felt very empowering though because, I'm in control now. I'm no longer subject to the demands of this lousy employer. I'm going to quit because I can. Doesn't it feel liberating?
I've been there, and I must say, you know, but I was a bit of a chicken. Instead of confronting my boss, I faxed her the letter of resignation. She took her many years to, because she was also kind of a friend, it took her many years to forgive me for that particular act. It's like divorcing somebody via SMS, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly.
It hurts a little more when you do it that way. Okay, taking us all the way up to 6:30 in the morning in the first bulletin is Iron and Wine, Grace for Saints and Ramblers. Stay tuned, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, that was Al Green with I'm Still in Love with You. I'm Sharad Kutan, and with me, Tan Chung Han. I'm still in love with you, Han, this morning. Also, we had a tweet from one of our listeners. Thank you, Shehzada. For your messages. Used to listen to BFM at the morning session, enjoying it. Keep it up. Blessed day ahead. Okay, that was very sweet.
Blessed
okay.
day to you as well, Shehzada.
Okay. Prime Minister Dato' Sri Najib Razak is on a 5-day working visit in Saudi Arabia, and he's not just there for business. A snapshot of his program booklet lists out his entourage, which has become subject of much chatter. It includes his mother, his wife, because that's Sri Rosma Manso, children, son-in-law, grandson, brother, as well as 4 special guests. Now, this might not have gotten the kind of life and legs that it's achieved, except for the fact that the entourage list was photographed and then went viral.
Mm. And I guess this story would not have the kind of legs as well if it wasn't for, say, the trust deficit that apparently is there between netizens and the current administration. Also, when it comes to, say, concerns over the efficient use of government funds, you know, taxpayer funds, right? So I guess that is why, you know, that's fueling its virality, if you may call it that. But to be fair, so the PMO, I believe, has responded, all right?
Yeah, they come out to clarify that his family have paid for their own travel expenses and other expenses as well for the trip. Apparently, the Prime Minister invited his family and acquaintances to join him for Umrah, or a minor pilgrimage to Mecca. Family members and guests were listed in the delegation, and I think there's some kind of chatter around that being identified, or rather accorded guest status is something that's quite important in diplomatic circles, and it means that then you're part of the official delegation and your expenses are footed by the government of the day, in this case the government of Malaysia.
Right, so apparently it's not common practice for an entire delegation to be accorded guest status, but I guess the relationships between Saudi Arabia and Malaysia are close enough whereby they can accord that guest status to the entire delegation.
You know, this is very interesting. You mentioned the trust deficit issue, Han, earlier. And I think it's not just here. It's in many parts of the world where people feel the political elite are having, a field day when they take power. And, you know, the longer they've been in power, the more they're likely to indulge in excesses. Now, but it doesn't even matter. Some new parties, if you remember, we just had the news recently that Lula, the former president of Brazil, has had his conviction upheld at at the federal court level. And, you know, the Workers' Party that came to power in Brazil really came with some sort of, you know, with an ideological mantle of helping people, uplifting people from poverty. And then you have all these stories that they became just the kind of people that they sought to displace, right? Mm-hmm. And that's very troubling.
Yeah, and look, these concerns are not unique to the Malaysian space, and certainly not unique to Brazil as well. Over in the States as well, I recall during my time there, there was plenty of outcry when it came to the Obamas taking their family trips as as well. So, I just did a quick Google search. There's this Newsweek article by Newsweek. This was back in just last year, 2017, just giving the total for how much these Obama family trips, you know, because when they go on trips, you got to have the Secret Service and all that, how much they cost taxpayers. So, for example, they highlight the annual trip that Michelle Obama takes with her kids without the president, right, to Aspen, Colorado, I guess, for skiing every year. Each time they go there, they shut down the entire airport at Aspen, and it costs each time per trip over $88,000 per trip, right? And so you got taxpayers are crying out, obviously those from the right wing more so than the left wing. So it's in this constant battle, right, between public perception of how their tax money is being used, you know, versus the current administration, right? And the responsibility that they have to make sure that, you know, these funds are being spent in the most efficient way possible.
So I guess for a lot of democratic governments around the world, the question of optics or public perception is very important. Mm. So you don't want to be seen straining the public purse, especially if you're trying to foist, say, austerity on people, right? And so,
or fiscal consolidation.
Whatever it is. You want to be seen to be not being excessive in your use of government funds. And you know, but on the other hand, you might argue that it's just the nature of things. Can the first family not then go anywhere just because they need this entourage of security, you know, and the security detail that comes along with it? I mean, would it be fair to say don't take holidays during that 4-year, you know, tenure? And in case of the Obamas, it was 8 years. So were the kids going to be locked up in the room and never learn how to ski?
Right, like a Princess Elsa from Frozen thing. Oh, that's a Disney reference.
Yes, so that's a movie that not on my movie watch list just because I'm not the right demographic.
Let it go, Shira.
Let it go.
But coming back to this particular instance, right? So the question here is, you know, could the prime minister's family members and close friends gone and perform the Umrah without being accorded guest status from the Saudi Arabian government?
And then attached to this, and of course we've had other instances when family members went with the prime minister, say to China. If I remember, his son Reza Aziz was there. He went and it became viral. So people were circling these photographs saying, who's that? Why is he on this thing? Especially coming out of that 1MDB debacle. So the optics, one wonders if the current administration is as concerned about the optics as netizens are.
Or you could do it the Trump way, give titles or pseudo positions to your relatives.
Family.
Yeah. And then it can come along, no problem.
Son-in-law, Jared Kushner, special envoy, Ivanka Trump, special envoy.
And Ivanka can sit warm the seat for you while you go out and mingle with the guests.
So yeah, Donald Trump Jr. doing all these high-level delegations. Hmm. Yeah, that's the strategy.
Yeah.
I think we'll pass that along. Okay, stay tuned. We'll be back. BFM 89.9. That was the incredible Aretha Franklin with Daydreaming. What a mellow tune.
That is a classic that I can get into, unlike the one we heard a couple of songs ago.
Oh.
That obscure musical.
Oh, from all over the world by ELO.
Yeah, sure.
That was brilliant. Oh, my goodness. ELO, brilliant band.
To each their own.
Yeah. Okay, Tan Chung Han there, striking a discordant note. Myself, Shira.
Hey, but we agree on Aretha Franklin.
We do. Okay, so it's just past 50 minutes after 6. It is the 11th of January 2018. Remember, you can always join this conversation at any point in time by WhatsApping us at 018-789-8899 or not hashtagging us, but tweeting us at BFM Radio. Okay, now talking about hashtags, the Me Too hashtag has become an amazing avalanche of, well, depending on who's looking, good things or bad things, right? Because they're essentially about accusations against people who've committed sexual crimes or have behaved in ways that diminished both men and women, but primarily women, in the workplace and their professional lives and such. Now, there has been that movement, Me Too, have spawned many imitators, including in France, where it was out your pig, pig being the person who's been bad in a sexual sense. But there also has been, and very recently, a backlash, or at least a push against it. Now, in France, 100 women writers, performers, and academics signed an open letter warning about the new puritanism sparked by the recent wave of Me Too accusations. The most famous of the signatories is Catherine Deneuve. She's a well-known French actress, has been in over 100 films.
Yeah, and diving into this letter by Ms. Deneuve, she says, and I quote, Well, the 100 women writers, say, and I quote, men have been punished summarily, forced out of their jobs when all they did was touch someone's knee or try to steal a kiss. So, you know, the pushback to this letter, you know, by certain feminist groups was that, you know, this seems to trivialize the kind of crimes that the Me Too movement aims to highlight.
Yeah, right? But let's stay with what Catherine Deneuve and these 100 women are trying to say first. Sure. Before, yeah, there is, as you're right, criticisms by feminists against Catherine Deneuve. Mm. In fact, and that's just to give some nuance to the position that Catherine Deneuve and those others have taken, says, and I'm quoting here, rape is a crime, but trying to seduce someone, even persistently or clumsily, is not. Nor is men being gentlemanly a chauvinist attack. I'm going to quote the letter. It says, as women, we do not recognize ourselves in this feminism, which, beyond denouncing the abuse of power, takes on a hatred of men and of sexuality. And so that last bit is about the puritanism they see that's happening in the kind of fallout from all this.
Right. But, I mean, I don't
you
know,
like you, I'm also slightly loath to talk about this without a woman in the room, because I think neither of us are on that side of the equation, having to face, perhaps not even on a daily basis, harassment from men, right?
Right. But I have witnessed personally. So for example, many of you may not know this, but I used to work on film sets or TV shows in the States, right, for Warner Brothers, HBO, that kind of stuff. And it is quite
rampant. And you quit that job to come home and serve the Malaysian public.
Well, that's a story for another day, okay? But yeah, you do see this. I mean, you want to talk about locker room talk, you want to see, you know, how women are viewed on set. It is very, very prevalent. In fact, one of the executive producers for one of the shows I worked on was accused of being sexually harassing the female actresses on that particular TV show as well. And so when I read that report, I was shocked. Why? Because this executive producer was very nice to me, very kind, and I obviously was very...
Not his type.
Well, and plus I'm a male, yeah. And I was very, obviously at the bottom of the hierarchy where I didn't see what actually happened behind closed doors, you know, obviously. So given given that this problem was so prevalent in Hollywood, perhaps this overreaction, and I'm using air quotes here, overreaction, at least, you know, some might call it overreaction, is somewhat justified given this pent-up frustration and anger that it's about time that this is actually being called out.
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's no doubt that, and even if you read the letter closely, it actually doesn't denounce the Me Too movement. It just points to what it sees as a tipping point in terms of what's happening. We know, of course, that many of the statements that have come out under the hashtag MeToo have been unsupported by evidence. Maybe evidence is hard to find in these instances, but it's unsupported by evidence. A lot of the allegations, often against powerful rich men. Maybe more powerful rich men are more, and heterosexual men are more likely to be perpetrators. In fact, not just heterosexual men, also Kevin Spacey, because famously, adding to that equation in terms of the gay men, the use of their power and influence to extract, pleasure from others.
Right. And then also you've got individuals, you know, high-profile individuals who have come out in support of the Me Too campaign only for their past, which, you know, to give them the benefit of the doubt, you know, they may have forgotten about, being dragged up. So a case in point would be James Franco. So he wore that Time's Up pin, right, to the Golden Globes. And then guess what? All the Twitter went crazy, with accusations of how he...
James Franco too?
Yeah, James Franco, yeah. You know, so accusations about how he may have not treated women with respect in the past, on previous gigs, So... It just becomes this, this pot of swirling allegations, and you really don't know who to believe.
Yeah. And so the question is, are all allegations of equal importance and merit or weight, right? And I think what you see in this letter is an attempt to calibrate the issues a little more finely so that you don't go from saying, well, touching somebody's knee or maybe making an advance to accusations of rape, and that they're very, very different. The non-consensual end of it, and correct me if I'm wrong, but Harvey Weinstein has never admitted to non-consensual sex. He says he might have acted badly, he might have been more brutish than he should have been, but he's never raped anybody. Mm. So that calibration is important.
Well, I think these nuances aside, I think the response here would be, kind of tilting it back towards being overly cautious. I think that should be the stance right now, at least.
Okay. Taking us to the top of the hour is Pearl Jam and Daughter. Stay tuned. BFM 89.9. Good morning. I'm Sharad Kuzin, with me, Tan Chung Han, and you're with The Morning Run, taking you all the way up to 10 o'clock in the morning. It, of course, is the 11th of January, 2018, and just past 6 after 7 in the morning. Now, we have often talked about the question of English and stories around the mangling of English, because the official term for Malaysian English is Manglish, which is maybe related to the question of mangling something, the verb there. Because we had that story from some time ago about a sign posted at the Perak Tourism Information Centre in Ipoh that used Google Translate.
Yeah, so the sign reads, and I quote, "Sorry for the complimentary. We are closing for the temporary." Kind of rhymes there. So Saturday and Sunday, because we had an unexpected problem with our networking and air conditioner issue. We are sure that we are being operated on January 2nd. TQ. Thank you.
Okay. So this prompted the Perak Menteri Besar, Dato' Sri Zamri Abdul Kadir, to remind civil servants not to rely on Google Translate when producing official documents or notices for the public. The question is, if they don't have a facility with the English language, what else would they rely on apart from something like Google Translate?
Well, no, you've got those Dwi Bahasa. Do you remember those dual language dictionaries?
Yeah, dictionaries just about the word.
Yeah, I mean, if you do word for word.
Yeah, because this is the problem, not just of bad usage of words, but also syntax and such. Though I must say, for us English speakers, we often go on to mangle Bahasa Malaysia.
That's right.
It's like, and I can imagine people who are very protective of the quality of our speech in the national language also are very aggrieved because they see around them the constant mangling of Malay by English speakers or people who speak other languages.
Yeah, and I totally agree. You know, I guess people very often forget the burden it comes with, being expected to be fluent or to be multilingual, right? Because very often when you look at, say, other developed countries, developed economies, where they are just expected to have this monoculture, right, where you just stick to your own, like, be the Japanese or Koreans, you don't expect the average Japanese or Korean to speak English. But in Malaysia, it's a very different dynamic. And often they point to, you had 11 years of schooling. You know, you had English classes from Standard 1 all the way to Form 5. You should rightfully be fluent in English. But if the tables are turned, like you rightly turned them, well, how is it that we've got so many urban English-speaking folk here in Malaysia who, despite having 11 years of classes in Bahasa, masih tak fasih lagi? Kenapa ni?
Yeah, I know. And, I must say, it is a terrible thing. We do get into our little linguistic silos from which we never emerge. Right. We're always peer out looking at the other language groups with some either suspicion or trepidation or, in some instances, unfortunately, contempt.
Yeah, and it also reinforces the idea that language is often learned and reinforced based on social agents more so than formal learning, right? Despite having 11 years of classes in either Bahasa or English, right? If you don't use it outside of the classroom, if you don't interact with your friends, family, etc.
Neighbors. Yeah,
right, in that language, then it just gets lost. So what if you took 11 years sitting in a classroom and filling out all those grammar workbooks and whatnot?
Yeah. Well, we turn to Professor Susan Phillips for her thoughts on the question of translation. She's an associate professor in the English department of the Faculty of Arts and Social Sciences at University of Malaya. We asked her whether bad translations stem from bad English or sheer laziness.
Well, I actually think it's not that simple. It's a combination of factors. First of all, yes, there is a poor command of English, which of course goes back to our education system. And this is one issue which will take decades to fix. Second, stemming from that, it's a lack of confidence or an awareness about how bad your English is. So if there's a lack of confidence, you might be too shy to ask for help. You might not know where to go for help. And if you're unaware, then of course you don't know you need help. And I think the third issue is kind of our blind trust in technology. Now, for example, I have used Google Translate. They say that the culprit here is Google Translate. I've used it, but I always go through it and make changes because I can spot the worst errors. The problem is if you can't spot errors or if you trust that errors won't be made. So I think to just put it down to sheer laziness is too simplistic. Laziness might come into it, but that's not the only reason.
Right. So I think one of the main takeaways for me from that was that you need to identify the errors, right? Google Translate is a tool, but it's not an adequate tool. It doesn't necessary, but it's not sufficient, as it were.
Yeah, but the ability to spot these mistakes even assumes that you've got some kind of underlying fundamentals where you're able to recognize those mistakes to begin with. Right,
right. Yeah. Absolutely. So now we ask Susan Phillips about the question of improving standards of English, something that, you know, we are, of course, very concerned about. And she says, and we asked her what she thinks are the main barriers for Malaysians from improving our English.
I would say right now in our education system, English isn't prioritized. You get a few hours a week for English. It's not a compulsory part right now, I think. So if you don't get enough exposure towards English in school and then again outside of school, how are you to improve? Because learning any language is a matter of practice. Right? There's also, I think, the issue of peer pressure, because I've seen this myself, where you might be seen as being a bit too hoity-toity or a bit too big for your boots if you try to improve your English, as if you're somehow forgetting your non-English roots. There's also, I think, some underlying sense that if you get better at English, you will somehow lose your mother tongue. You will lose your own culture, which might well happen in some cases, but it is a matter of going back to your education system and maintaining some kind of balance between the two, between your mother tongue and between English, and also acknowledging the value and utility of having competence in more than one language, which is very important, which perhaps that message is not getting out strongly enough.
Okay, that was Professor Susan Phillip, Associate Professor at the English Department of University of Malaya, her thoughts on the standards of English in our country. We had a tweet from Matthew. He says, if you're a tourism department, you need to have people who can speak English. But not just English, because we have French tourists, we have German tourists, we have Japanese, Chinese tourists, Mandarin-speaking, Hindi-speaking tourists as well, don't we?
Yeah, but given that English is the lingua franca, you know, opportunity cost, you know, which is the most efficient one, then you go with English. Yeah.
Okay, but it also is about a kind of bias. There is a bias towards English, yeah, that is unhelpful. At the end of the day, we do want to have people from around the world and to empower Malaysians to be more global, you know, to speak good Bahasa Indonesia, for instance, or speak good Mandarin at this point in time. Perhaps even more important, considering the rise of China and the rise of Indonesia as our neighbor, maybe that's also very important.
No, I totally agree with you, because as a non-Mandarin speaking Chinese, I mean, I've got enough to go by, you know, I can survive, right? But I am, you know, totally at loss. At a loss when it comes to being able to communicate, oh, not just in English, but
you
in
didn't
Chinese
study
as well.
Mandarin?
I mean, I did until Standard 4, and then I gave it all up, right?
我不会讲华语.
Oh, well done. That's more than I can say, I think. So, look, but it's also recognizing that when we are forced, and I'm using that rather loosely, but, you know, forced, or we are pressured to be able to communicate communicate in multiple languages, there's bound to be some kind of dilution, right? You expect
Absolutely.
I find that myself because, okay, on radio, you have to speak in a more formal tone, right? You're supposed to use grammar and all
I speak like this at home.
Oh, really? Well, that explains
even to
a lot.
The fishmonger.
That's why you don't have friends, buddy.
Ooh, ouch, burn. Okay, mic drop.
But then you have to transition into another code when talking to your peers, right, your friends. And then I have to speak in Malay to my Dobby lady. Then I have to speak in Mandarin to my relatives and et cetera, to my neighbors. So, you know, this constant hopping back and forth is going to mess you up. Or it's messed me up, right? So I think the expectations, that has to be managed somewhat and, you know, perhaps alleviated, maybe?
Yeah, I agree with you completely. And I think also what Susan Phillips mentioned, this thing about losing your roots or becoming too big for your britches, that's also there. Poyo, I think, is the expression in Malay for people who are kind of like, you know, trying to show off, right? Yeah. And usually using English is kind of, you know, attracts that kind of charge, right? Mm. Oh, you're trying to be sophisticated and cosmopolitan. Wish we could get over that, but okay.
And then with the accents, right? Because, you know, if we have spent some time abroad and we... And then once we start adopting, you know, some semblance of an accent, oh, then people, you know, the pitchforks come out. Like, oh, you get off your high horse. You're a Malaysian. It's like, speak like Isla.
Okay.
So bitter.
I can see where the pain is coming from. Now, if you have opinions about this, of course, you can always WhatsApp us at 018-789-8899 or tweet us. Thank you very much, Matthew, for your tweet there. We'll be back with news and analysis. Stay tuned. BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9. The Business Station.